History of the Bands.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to History of the Bands. I am your host, the human Google machine, Brandon Withers. How is everybody's? I's doing goods. Like, literally, I do goods. Anyway, on this episode, I will talk about the band Black Sabbath from 1968 to 1978. Yes, only 10 years, but like the Alice Cooper episode, there is so much to go over. So I will, like, do the Alice Cooper type thing here, you know, do a little bit and return to it later. So now on to Black Sabbath. They are a English rock band formed in Birmingham, England in 1968. They are often cited as pioneers of heavy metal music. Black Sabbath have sold over 70 million records worldwide, making them one of the most commercially successful heavy metal bands of all time. They were ranked by MTV as the greatest metal band of all time, just saying, and placed second on the VH1's 100 Greatest Artists of Hard Rock. Rolling Stones magazine ranked them at number 85 of their 100 Greatest Artists of All Time. Black Sabbath was inducted into the UK Hall of Fame in 2005 and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. They have also won 2 Grammy Awards, and in 2019 the band were presented with a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. So let's get started. Class is in session. First, let's talk about Tony Iommi, born Anthony Frank Iommi Jr. on February 19, 1948 in Birmingham, England. His parents were Italian immigrants. They are Sylvia Maria and, of course, Anthony Frank Iommi Sr. Tony was an only child. His mother's family were vineyard owners in Italy. The family was Catholic, though they rarely attended Mass. Their family home in the Park Lane area of Ashton also housed a shop, which was a popular meeting place in the neighborhood, with the living room doubling as the shop's stockroom. His mother ran the shop while his father was a carpenter by trade. He attended Birchfield Road School, where his future bandmate Ozzy was also attending just 1 year behind him. At the age of 8 or 9, while being chased by another boy, Tony fell and cut his upper lip. As a result, he gained the nickname Scarface, which made him more self-conscious of the scar, so he eventually grew his trademark mustache as a means of covering it. At about age 10, Tony began working out and learning judo, karate, and later boxing as a means of protecting himself from the local gangs which congregated in his neighborhood. Tony initially wanted to play the drums, but due to excessive noise, he chose the guitar instead as a teenager after being inspired by the likes of Hank Marvin and the Shadows. He has always played guitar left-handed. After completing school, Tony worked briefly as a plumber and later in a factory manufacturing rings. He stated that at one point he worked in a music store, but quit after being falsely accused of stealing. Now, while working at the factory when he was 17, he lost the tips of his middle and ring fingers on his right hand. Now, he used his right hand for the fretboard on the guitar. He was told he would never play again. This destroyed Tony. He was down on his luck. His former boss man was insisting on Tony to listen to jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt. Tony resisted at first, but later they sat down and listened to this record that the boss man kept saying, "Hey, come on, man, come listen to this." His boss asked him what he thought, and Tony said it was really good. Then his boss told him that Django was only playing with two fingers on the fretboard because of an accident he had had in a fire. Tony decided to go for it and continue playing the guitar, but it was painful on his fingertips. So he fitted homemade thimbles to his injured fingers to extend and protect them. The thimbles were made from an old fairy liquid bottle. He melted it down, got it hot, and shaped it like a finger, and cut sections from a leather jacket to cover his new homemade prosthetics, which created two technical problems. First, the thimbles prevented him from feeling the strings, causing a tendency to press down very hard on them. Second, he had difficulty bending strings, leading him to seek light gauge guitar strings to make it easier to do so. Tony had played in several blues rock bands. One of the earliest bands was the Rockin' Chevrolets from 1964 to 1965. Tony later joined the Birds and the Bees from 1966 to 1967. Tony played in a band named The Rest. It was in The Rest that Tony first met future Black Sabbath drummer Bill Ward, who played drums and sang in the band. From January until July of 1968, Tony was the guitarist of the Mythology, with Ward joining a month later in mid-February. In May 1968, police raided the group's practice flat and found weed, which resulted in fines for the band members. Most significantly, the incident made it quite difficult for the band to secure future bookings, as most club owners avoided bands they viewed as drug users. Mythology split up after a gig on July 13, 1968. In September, Tony briefly joined Jethro Tull. However, after only two performances, Tony left. Now I know that was a lot, but hey, there is a lot to know. Now, since I spoke about him, let's talk about Bill Ward. Born William Thomas Ward on May 5th, 1948 in Birmingham, England. Bill started to play the drums as a child, listening to the big bands of the 1940s. His early major influences were Gene Krupa, Buddy Rich, and Louis Belson. Later, he was influenced by drummers such as Joe Morello, Keith Hartley, Huggy Flint, John Bonham, Ringo Starr, Jim Capaldi, and Clive Bunker. In the mid-1960s, Ward sang and played drums in a band called The Rest, which I spoke about, before he and guitarist Tony played together in a band called Mythology, which I had just talked about. And upon the band's dissolution, joined vocalist Ozzy Osbourne and bassist Geezer Butler, who had previously played together in a band called Rare Breed. So now let's talk about Geezer Butler, born Terrence Michael Joseph Butler on July 17, 1949. Hey, that's my birthday, just 40 years prior to when I was born. Yeah, he's 40 years older than me. Anyway, Butler adopted the nickname Geezer at an early age. It came about when he was at school. His brother was in the army, and he was based with a lot of Cockneys, which is a term used from East London natives, and people in London called everybody a geezer. It's just like somebody calling you dude over here, you know, like, "Hey dude, what's up dude?" You know, that kind of stuff, which I don't say "what's up dude" anymore. You know, I've gotten too old for that crap. Most time I go, "Hey man, what's up?" Oh, I do say "what's up." Holy crap. Epiphany. Boom. Anyway. So, his brother used to come home from leave from the army, and he'd be going, "Hello, Geezer, how are you?" So, because Butler looked up to his big brother when he was about 7 years old, he'd go to school calling everybody a geezer. So that is how he got the nickname. Butler grew up in a working-class Irish Catholic family. Both of his parents were born in Dublin. The family had 7 children and were poor, typically having no money whatsoever, which I know what it's like. Anyway, the family home had no telephone, hot water, or bathroom, and considered itself lucky to have their own outside toilet. Yeah, they were lucky to have that outside toilet. Some of their neighbors had to share a toilet. Butler was heavily influenced by the writing of Aleister Crowley as a teenager. By his late teens, he had stopped attending Mass. He cited a loss of belief and feels that everyone should, sooner or later, decide for themselves what to believe in. And now, the Prince of Darkness. Ozzy Osbourne, born John Michael Osbourne, on December 3rd, 1948, in Marston Green, Warwickshire, England. His mother, Lillian, was a non-observant Catholic who worked days at a Lucas factory. His father, John Thomas Jack Osbourne, worked night shifts as a toolmaker at the General Electric Company. Osbourne had 3 older sisters, Jean, Iris, and Jillian, and 2 younger brothers, Paul and Tony. The family lived in a small 2-bedroom home. Osbourne had the nickname Ozzy since primary school. Ozzy also dealt with dyslexia at school, which I know what it's like. At the age of 11, he suffered sexual abuse from school bullies. Ozzy claimed to have attempted suicide multiple times as a teenager. He left school at 15 and was employed as a construction site worker. When he was young, he dabbled in crime and spent 6 weeks in Winston Green Prison when he was unable to pay a fine after being convicted of robbing a clothes store. To teach his son a lesson, his father refused to pay the fine. Ozzy participated in school plays, including Gilbert and Sullivan's, The Mikadoos, and HMS. He possesses a hesitant Brummie accent. When one of the first Beatles songs come out at the age of 14, Ozzy became a fan of the band and credited the Beatles' 1963 song, She Loves You, for inspiring him to become a musician. So how the band came to be was following the breakup of the Mythology in 1968, Tony and Bill sought to form a heavy blues rock band in Birmingham. They enlisted Geezer and Ozzy Osbourne, who had played together in a band called Rare Breed. Ozzy had placed an advertisement in local music shop, and it read, "Ozzy Zig needs a gig, has own PA." The new group was initially named the Pocotoke Blues Band. The Pocotoke Blues Band included slide guitarist Jimmy Phillips, a childhood friend of Ozzy, and a saxophonist, Alan Clark. After shortening the name to Pocotoke, the band again changed their name to Earth and continued as a 4-piece without Phillips and Clark. Tony became concerned that Phillips and Clark lacked the necessary dedication and were not taking the band seriously. Rather than asking them to leave, they instead decided to break up and then quietly reform the band as a 4-piece. While the band was performing under the Earth moniker, they recorded several demos written by Norman Haynes, such as The Rebel, When I Came Down, and Song for Jim, which being a reference to Jim Simpson, who was a manager for the band's Bakerloo Blues Line and T.N. Symphony. Simpson had recently started a new club named Henry Blues House at the Crown Hotel in Birmingham and offered to let Earth play there after they agreed to waive the usual support band fee in return for free t-shirts. The audience response was positive, and Simpson agreed to manage Earth. In December 1968, Tony abruptly left Earth to join Jethro Tull, which I spoke about moments ago. Although his stint with the band would be short-lived, Tony made an appearance with Jethro Tull on the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus TV show. Unsatisfied with the direction of Jethro Tull, Tony returned to Earth by the end of the month. While playing shows in England in 1969, the band discovered they were being mistaken for another English group band named Earth. So they decided to change their name again. A cinema across the street from the band's rehearsal room was showing the 1963 horror film Black Sabbath. While watching people in line up to see the film, Butler noted that it was strange that people spend so much money to see scary movies. Following that, Ozzy and Butler wrote the lyrics for the song called Black Sabbath, which was inspired by the work of horror and adventure story writing Dennis Wheatley, along with a vision that Butler had of a black silhouette figure standing at the foot of his bed, making use of the musical tritone, also known as the Devil's Interval. The song's ominous sound and dark lyrics pushed the band in a darker direction, a stark contrast to the popular music of the late 1960s, which was dominated by flower power, folk music, and hippie culture. Judas Priest frontman Rob Halford has called the track probably the most evil song ever written. Inspired by the new sound, the band changed their name to Black Sabbath in August of 1969 and made the decision to focus on writing similar material in an attempt to create the musical equivalent of horror films. The band's first show as Black Sabbath took place on August 30th, 1969 in Workington, England. They were signed to Philip Records in November of 1969. So that was pretty quick right there. Anyway, they released their first single, Evil Woman, a cover of the song by the band Crow, which was recorded at Trident Studios through Philip Records' secondary, Fontana Records, in January 1970, Black Sabbath's first major exposure came when the band appeared on John Peel's Top Gear radio show in 1969, performing Black Sabbath and numerous other songs off their upcoming album to a national audience in Great Britain shortly before recording of their first album commenced. So their first album is Black Sabbath, released on February 13, 1970 by Vertigo and produced by Roger Bain. This album was recorded in a single 12-hour session on October 16, 1969. Ozzy said once they finished, they spent a couple of hours double-tracking some of the guitars and vocals, and that was it. It was done. They were in the pub in time for last orders. Ozzy went on to say, that's how albums should be made. Tony began recording the album with a white Fender Stratocaster, his guitar of choice at the time, but a malfunctioning pickup forced him to finish recording with a Gibson SG, a guitar he had recently purchased as a backup but had never really played. The SG was a right-handed model, which a left-handed Tony played upside down. Soon after recording the album, he met a right-handed guitarist who was playing a left-handed SG upside down, and the two agreed to swap guitars. The track list is Black Sabbath, The Wizard, Behind the Wall of Sleep, NIB, Evil Woman, Sleeping Village, and Warning. For a total length of 38 minutes and 8 seconds, it peaked at number 23 on the Billboards and has gone platinum. The album got negative reviews from critics. Rolling Stone's critic described the band as just like Cream, but worse. And he dismissed the album as a shuck slash despite of murky song titles and some insane lyrics that sound like Vanilla Fudge paying tribute to Aleister Crowley. The album has nothing to do with spiritualism, the occult, or anything much except stiff recitations of Cream cliches. A writing for the Village Voice claimed that the album was bullcrap necromancy. He later described it as a reflection of the worst of the counterculture, including drug-impaired reaction time and long solos. Ouch, like nobody, no critics liked this album. And that was just a rough review from them. But as the years have gone by, the album has become a well-loved album. In 1989, Kerrang ranked Black Sabbath at number 31 on their 100 Greatest Heavy Metal Albums of All Time. This album is now generally accepted as the first heavy metal album. The band returned to the studio in June of 1970, just 4 months after Black Sabbath was released, to record their second album, It Is Paranoid, released on September 18, 1970, in the UK, and it wasn't released in the US till January 1971 by Vertigo and Warner Brothers. It was produced by Roger Bain again. The album title track was written as a afterthought. As Bill Ward explained, they didn't have enough songs for the album and Tony just played a guitar lick and that was it. It took 20 to 25 minutes from top to bottom. The song Paranoid just like crystallized the band's writing process, with Tony initiating the idea with his riffs and Ozzy working on the melody, Geezer providing drive and the majority of the lyrics, and Bill locking into a set of often pounding rhythms beneath Butler's bass rumble. You know what I mean? Like, it was just so much stuff in that one. Like, I mean, that whole song is great. The single was released in August of 1970 and reached number 4 on the UK charts, remaining Black Sabbath's only top 10 hit. Most of the songs on Paranoid evolved during onstage improvisational jams. The track list is War Pigs, Paranoid, Planet Caravan, Iron Man, Electric Funeral, Hand of Doom, Rat Salad, and Fairies Wear Boots, for a total length of 41 minutes and 51 seconds. The album has peaked at number 12 on the Billboards and has gone 4 times platinum. Now, there was some controversy 4 years later about this album. So in 1974, a nurse named Hilary Pollard from North Yorkshire was found dead between a pair of speakers and the Paranoid album on her turntable. She had overdosed on sleeping tablets with a small enough dosage to make suicide inconclusive. However, the album's possible influence in her potential suicide was still mentioned in the inquest, but ultimately it was decided that Black Sabbath were not to blame for her death. Tony said, and I quote, "A lot of the words in the songs, a lot of the moods of the songs are aggressive, especially in the early days, satanic-like. That was the way it felt, so that was the way we played. But it got out of hand. With Paranoid in England, for instance, there was a girl found dead. A nurse, like, she was dead in her room with our album on the turntable going around. And it was taken to court saying that it was because of the album and that she was depressed and killed herself, which was totally ridiculous, I think." Unquote. What do you guys think? Did she do it because of the album? Like, really, do y'all think she did it? I don't think she did it because of the album. Anyway, let's move on. The album was very well loved by critics, and in retrospect, all music critics said it was one of the greatest and most influential heavy metal albums of all time. So in early 1971, the band went back to the studio to work on their third album called Master of Reality, released in August of 1971 by Vertigo and produced by Roger Bain. This was to be Bane's final collaboration with Black Sabbath. Now, this is funny. During the album's recording session, Ozzy brought Tony a large joint, which caused the guitarist to cough uncontrollably. Tony was recording acoustic guitar parts at the time, and his coughing fit was captured on tape. It is also used in another song that is about getting high. The track list is Sweet Leaf, After Forever, Embroyo, Children of the Grave, Orchard, Lord of This World, Solitude, and Into the Void, for a total length of 34 minutes and 29 seconds. The album peaked at number 8 in the United States and has gone double platinum. Despite the album's commercial success, it was viewed with disdain by contemporary music critics. One of the critics said it was a dim-witted exploitation. But by 1994, the album was ranked at number 28 in the Colin Larkin's Top 50 Heavy Metal Albums. Larkin described it as Sabbath's first real international breakthrough and a remarkable piece of work. Following the Masters of Reality World Tour in 1972, the band took their first break in 3 years. The band started to become very fatigued and very tired. They had been on the road nonstop, year in and year out, constantly touring and recording. By May of 1972, the band got their rest and was ready to record again. They flew out to LA and recorded their fourth album called Volume 4. Released in September of 1972 by Vertigo and produced by Patrick Meehan and Black Sabbath themselves. Tony did most of the producing, so he was the main one technically. Patrick was there to help out. The recording was plagued with problems, many due to substance abuse. In the studio, the band regularly had speaker boxes full of cocaine delivered. During recording, Bill thought he was about to be fired because he struggled to record a certain song. Ozzy said that eventually he started to wonder where the heck all the coke was coming from. That coke was the whitest, purest, strongest stuff you could ever imagine. One sniff and you were the kings of the universe. Alright, that's a good way to describe drug use, I guess. Or at least cocaine drug use. Screw cocaine, it's bad for you. That Colombian Bam Bam, no good for you guys. Ozzy can tell you that. Colombian Bam Bam, no good. Anyway, the track list is Wheels of Confusion, Tomorrow's Dream, Changes, FX, Supernaut, Snowblind, Cornucopia, Laguna Sunrise, St. Vitus Dance, and Under the Sun, for a total length of 42 minutes and 18 seconds. While most of the critics of this era were dismissive of the album, it achieved a gold status in less than a month and was the band's fourth consecutive release to sell 1 million copies in the United States, making it platinum. It reached number 13 on the billboards too. Following an extensive tour of the United States, the band toured Australia for the first time in 1973 and later in Europe. During a show at the Hollywood Bowl, the cocaine abuse caught up with Tony. Basically, Tony and the guys had been doing coke literally for days, but Tony had gone over the edge. He walked off the stage and collapsed. During sound check at that, I bet you that kind of hurt, guys. I'm just going to say, you know, you're on stage jamming. Next thing you know, you fall off and go, wee! Anyway, during sound check earlier that same day, a crazed Christian man attempted to storm the stage and stab Tony with a dagger, but he was tackled by members of the band's crew. Now, that is totally wild. You know, if you're Christian, which, you know, I claim to be one. I'm not a very good one, but I always try to do what's right. But, I mean, Christians don't want to stab people. But during this time frame, I guess he was doing drugs too, probably. And he was like, you are against God, and went for him. Anyway, let's move on here. Ozzy also recounted the band's ongoing anxiety over the possibility of being busted, which worsened after they went to the movies to see The French Connection about undercover New York City cops busting an international heroin smuggler. Ozzy said that by the time the credits rolled, he was hyperventilating. So when the tour was done, the band went back to LA and started working on their fifth album. This album is Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, released in November of 1973 by Vertigo and produced by Black Sabbath. The band rented a house in Bel Air and began writing in the summer of 73, but due in part to substance abuse and fatigue, were unable to complete any songs. Ideas weren't coming out the way they were on Volume 4, and they really just got discouraged. The band were also disappointed to discover that the room they had used previously at the Record Planet had been replaced with a giant synthesizer by Stevie Wonder, who had recently recorded there. After a month in Los Angeles with no results, the band opted to return to the UK, where they rented Clearwell Castle in the Forest of Dean, in which the likes of Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple wrote and recorded. The medieval surroundings may have revitalized the band musically, but also left a sinister impression. In a telling on the recording process in 1998, Tony said, and I quote, "We rehearsed in an armory there, and one night I was walking down the corridor with Ozzy and we saw a figure in a black cloak. We followed this figure back to the armory and there was absolutely no one there. Whoever it was had disappeared into thin air. The people that owned the castle knew all about this ghost and they said, oh yes, that's the ghost of so-and-so. And we were like, what? Unquote. Butler said, and I quote, "We rehearsed in the dungeons and it was really creepy, but it had some atmosphere. It conjured up things and stuff started coming out again," unquote. While working in the dungeons, Tony stumbled onto the main riff of Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, which set the tone for the new material. The track list is Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, A Natural Acrobat, Fluff, Sabra Cadabra, Killing Yourself to Live, Who Are You, Looking for Today, and Spiral Architect, for a total length of 42 minutes and 35 seconds. The album peaked at number 11 and has gone platinum. For the first time in their career, the band began to receive favorable reviews in the mainstream press, with Rolling Stones calling the album an extraordinary, gripping affair, and nothing less than a complete success. The band began a world tour in January of 1974, which ended at the California Jam Festival in Ontario, California on April 6, 1974, attracting over 200,000 fans. Black Sabbath appeared alongside popular 1970s rock and pop bands Deep Purple, Eagles, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Rare Earth, Seals and Crofts, Black Oak Arkansas, and Earth, Wind, and Fire. Which, that's a pretty good lineup. I like some of those bands there. Anyways, portions of the show was telecast on ABC's television in the U.S., exposing the band to a wider American audience. In the same year, the band shifted management, signing with notorious English manager Don Arden. The move caused a contractual dispute with Black Sabbath's former management, and while on stage in the U.S., Ozzy was handed a subpoena that led to 2 years of litigation. Well, in February of 1975, the band went back to the studio to work on their sixth album in England at Morgan Studios in London. It is called Sabotage, released on July 28, 1975 by Vertigo and produced by Black Sabbath and Mike Butcher. The title Sabotage was chosen because the band was, at the time, being sued by their former management and felt that they were being sabotaged. Tony credited those legal troubles for the album's angry, heavier sound, so much of the time, when they weren't on stage or in the studio, they were in a lawyer's office trying to get out of all their contracts. Sabotage sessions were the scene of a legendary jam session between Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. Tony's recollection may be inaccurate, however, as records show that Zeppelin were on tour in the U.S. at the time of Sabotage was being recorded. Bill Ward's recollection of the exact timing of the Zeppelin jam session is also fuzzy. He said he don't even know what album they were working on, but one of John Bonham's favorite songs was Supernaut. So when they came down to the studio, he wanted to jam to Supernaut. It is more likely that the jam sessions took place during the recording of the previous album, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, though. But hey, all these guys, you know, were kind of like on drugs, so they don't remember nothing. The track list is Hole in the Sky, Don't Start, Symptoms of the Universe, Megalomania, Thrill of It All, Super Dessert, Am I Going Insane, and The Writ, for a total length of 43 minutes and 44 seconds. The album peaked at number 7 in the UK and at number 28 in the US. The album has since gone gold. Now, critics seem to really like this album. Rolling Stone says Sabotage is not Black Sabbath's best record since Paranoid. It might be their best ever. So that's a big statement right there. The band toured in the U.S. in support of Sabotage in 1975, which included a film appearance for the series Rock Concerts at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. Sabbath played Killing Yourself to Live, Hole in the Sky, Snowblind, War Pigs, and Paranoid. During Tony's guitar solo during Snowblind, plastic snowflakes were dropped from above on the audience and the band, a gimmick used during the band's live shows during that period. Due to the band's expanding use of orchestras and other new sounds in the studio, the tour in support of Sabotage was the first in which Black Sabbath used a full-time keyboardist on stage, Gerald G's Woodruff. Black Sabbath toured with openers Kiss, but were forced to cut their tour short in November of 75 after Ozzy was injured in a motorcycle accident. The band went back to the studios, but not in England or LA. You see, after frustrating legal battles that accompany the recordings of 1975's Sabotage, Sabbath chose Miami Studios for the making of their seventh album, Technical Ecstasy, released on September 25th, 1976 by Vertigo and produced by Black Sabbath. This album continued the band's separation from the doom and darkness and had been a trademark of their earlier albums. The sessions proved extremely relaxing for everyone except Tony, who was left to oversee the production while the others tanned themselves on the beaches. To make matters worse for the band, manager Don Aldrin began spending more of his time focusing on another one of his acts, Electric Light Orchestra, whose album Face the Music was their first to make the U.S. top 10. Ozzy admitted that he began to consider leaving the band during this time and even had a t-shirt made with Blizzard of Oz written on the front. While the band were recording the album, the Eagles were recording Hotel California in the adjacent studio. Before they could start recording, they had to scrape all the cocaine out of the mixing board. The Eagles were forced to stop recording on numerous occasions because Sabbath were being too loud and the sounds was coming through the walls. The album lyrics dealt with a variety of topics as well. The track list is Backstreet Kids, You Won't Change Me, It's Alright, Gypsy, All Moving Parts, Rock and Roll Doctor, She's Gone, and Dirty Women, for a total length of 40 minutes and 35 seconds. The album peaked at number 51 on the billboards and went gold. The album received mixed reviews. One critic said the band was trying to stretch its sound in several directions, which none of them was exceptionally successful. During the 1977 European tour, in support of the album, the band was supported by AC/DC. The relationships between Geezer and AC/DC's Malcolm Young were quite tense. Tony said the atmosphere between the two was heavy, and that the pair did not get along at all. An altercation occurred in a hotel bar in which Butler removed a switchblade comb from his pocket and opened it. Young thought it was an actual switchblade knife and believed Butler was pointing it at him. Also during the tour, Bill had began driving from gig to gig in a rented Winnebago due to the fear of flying. Ozzy briefly left following the tour. Although he would eventually return for the next album called Never Say Die, released on September 29, 1978 by Vertigo and produced by Black Sabbath. At the time of the recording of Never Say Die, the members of Black Sabbath were all heavily involved in drugs and alcohol abuse. So while Ozzy was gone, the band replaced him with a guy named Walker. They had wrote a few songs before Ozzy came back. Ozzy refused to sing one of the songs and reworked a song and made it about his father who had passed away. The track list is Never Say Die, Johnny Blade, Junior's Eyes, A Hard Road, Shockwave, Air Dance, Over to You, Breakout, and Swinging the Chain for a total length of 45 minutes and 41 seconds. The album peaked at number 69 on the billboards and has went gold. Rolling Stone said it is not a blaze of glory for the original foursome, but added that it may be better than people might remember. Another critic said that it was disastrous. Black Sabbath's Never Say Die tour opened on May 16, 1978 in Sheffield with Van Halen as their opening act, who just scored a hit in the US with a cover of the Kinks' You Really Got Me. After Sabbath finished their soundcheck, Van Halen hit the stage and started to play Sabbath tunes. It was their way of paying tribute to the band, but Tony was annoyed by it. He may have misinterpreted the gesture as a piss take, which it certainly was not. Van Halen were in awe of Sabbath, and their lead guitarist Eddie Van Halen was a big fan of Tony, but all of this was soon forgotten. The two bands eventually came together and got along very well, and Alex Van Halen would often sit behind Bill's drum kit, watching and listening to him play on stage. On the US leg of the tour, Van Halen's presence had a major influence on ticket sales since they were a much bigger draw at home than they were in the UK. Now, there was two riots that occurred during the Never Say Die tour. The first happening in Bran, Germany, in front of a hall crammed with thousands of extremely stoned, drunk, and rowdy GIs. When three songs into the show, Tony walked off the stage because of a buzzing coming from his guitar stack. When the audience realized the band had quit the gig, they wrecked the hall. Another riot happened in Nashville when Ozzy didn't show up and the band had to cancel. It later came to light that Ozzy basically just got so high that he slept right through the alarm clock, woken up and seen it said 6 o'clock and was thinking it was still the day before. Even more incredibly, he had been sleeping in the wrong room. Several U.S. dates featured the Ramones as the openers, either in addition to or replacing Van Halen. The New York City punk band was eager to expand their fan base and considered themselves to have more in common with the hard rock bands of 1978. Following the tour, Black Sabbath returned to L.A. and again rented a house in Bel Air, where they spent nearly a year working on new material for the next album. The entire band were abusing both alcohol and other drugs, but Tony said Ozzy was on a total different level altogether. The band would come up with new song ideas, but Ozzy showed little interest and was refusing to sing them. Pressure from the record label and frustrations with Ozzy's lack of input coming to a head, Tony made the decision to fire Ozzy in 1979. Tony believed the only options available were to fire Ozzy or break up the band completely. Well, that is it for this episode, and I'm going to stop right here on this part. So, this will be Black Sabbath Part 1. I will do a part two down the road. Might even do a take on Ozzy's career afterwards. This band has influenced so many people and created heavy metal music. Like, really, I'm being honest. Paranoid's amazing. Iron Man, of course, is like their biggest hit. Because, you know, you got the Iron Man movies that made it to the younger crowd now. But even beforehand, I mean, Iron Man was so awesome. That guitar riff, that dun, 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 dun. You know what I mean? It's just amazing. And like, all their albums are just great back then, man. I loved them. So let's list my top five albums from the beginning to this point. Coming in at number five is Master of Reality. Number four is Black Sabbath. Number three is Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. Number two is Volume 4. And number one is Paranoid. This is my top five, and it is what it is. You do not want to miss this next episode, as I'm going to be talking about the White Stripes. But as always, if you want to, you know, see silly videos and whatnot, you can head over to my TikTok, Facebook, or Instagram, or even YouTube, and see all the silly videos and updates that I do for the show. As well as in each one of those, you have a link that you can click, and you can go over and buy yourself some merch or get you guys some better help. So I highly recommend that. Go follow the show, and please give me 5-star reviews. Leave a comment. Let me know if I'm doing good or bad. You know, I've been told I've done bad. I've been told I've been doing awesome. So it is what it is, guys. Anyway, only got one thing left to say, and that is class dismissed.
History of the Bands.